Good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. James Taylor, Director of African American Studies and the Professor of Political Science at the University of San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Thomas Frank. He's a historian, a political analyst, and author of the new book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He likes for it to be announced, "Listen, people, listen, liberal," with the exclamation. What's the Matter with Kansas was his best-selling book that I've actually used in my classes, I just told him. Thomas Frank is noted for analyzing trends in American electoral politics, popular culture, mainstream journalism, and economics. He's a former columnist for Harper's and the Wall Street Journal and co-founded and edited The Baffler. He also holds a doctorate in history for the University of Chicago, and his wife and two daughters are here with him today. Dr. Frank started his political journey as a college Republican, but has come to be highly critical of conservatism. Mr. Frank summarized the thesis of his book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, as bad government is the natural product of rule by those who believe government is bad. In his latest book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, he postulates that liberals like to believe that if only Democrats can continue to dominate national elections, if only those awful Republicans are beaten into submission, then the country will be on the right course. But he says this view fundamentally misunderstands the modern Democratic Party. Dr. Frank says, and he doesn't like to be called doctor too much, that the Democrats have, in fact, done little to advance traditional liberal agendas. In fact, he says the Democrats have occupied the White House for 16 of the last 24 years, and yet the decline of the middle class has only accelerated under the Democrats. Wall Street gets its bailouts, wages keep falling, and the free trade deals keep coming. He is celebrating the victory of the Kansas City Royals World Series Championship. We in San Francisco know a little bit of something about that. We want to welcome them to the family. And he's also celebrating a birthday this week, so we want to wish him happy birthday as well. Yes. So please welcome Thomas Frank.
Thank you very much, Dr. Taylor. Can y'all hear me? Is that good? Is it okay? I don't even think we need this, right? I've got that William Jennings Bryan style speaking. The resonant voice. No, I don't really have that. I have the whiny nasal Kansas City accent, the Harry Truman accent. So I, like Dr. Taylor says, I've spent the last 16 years of my life writing about conservatives. I should say, you know, before I start in on this, I come out here every 4 years to talk to you guys here at the Commonwealth Club, and it's always a blast. I love doing it, but every 4 years I come out here because there's another election and people are interested in this stuff. And also every 4 years, a friend of mine comes over from Paris, France, where he edits a newspaper, and we drive around the country and look at this and that, and he says to me, he said to me last time he was over here, he said, you know, Tom, I come over here every 4 years, and every 4 years it's a little bit worse. And, you know, he's exactly right. And so here I am again, 4 years later. And you know me as the guy that's written all of these books about conservatives and conservatism. And one of the books that's, my best-known book about my home state of Kansas was about, you know, the theme of it was about the many ways in which the Republican Party has, over the years, has roped in working-class people. You know, all the different like species of fake populism that they invented in order to do that. And today, I think, as we're watching the rise of probably the greatest fake populist of all time, right? Donald Trump, right? I mean, this guy is Huey Long minus the compassion. That's what this guy is. But as we watch this happening, I want to talk about something that I hinted at in What's the Matter with Kansas, but didn't really go into in detail, which is just this, that a good helping of the blame for this right-wing backlash that we have lived with all these years, that a good helping of the blame for this has to go to Democrats as well. That the degree to which the Republicans have won these people over is the same degree to which the Democrats have abandoned them. And so I think this is most definitely the year to ask whatever happened to the party of the people. And I mean this question in two different ways. First of all, how did the Democrats come to abandon working people, the middle class of this country? And in a related point, how is it that they failed to respond to what I believe is the greatest political challenge of our time? What failure do I mean by that? Well, President Obama himself has said, and I think he's right when he says this, that inequality is the defining challenge of our time. Now, that is a sweeping statement, of course, but you think about it for more than a couple of seconds and you realize it isn't anywhere near sweeping enough. I don't like this word inequality. I think it's, you know, I think it's a euphemism, but you think about what it means. This is shorthand. This is the way we talk about all the things that have gone to make the lives of the rich so much more delicious year on year for three decades. And at the same time, it's a word that stands for all the things that have made the lives of working people so wretched and so precarious. Inequality. Inequality is what we mean when we talk about the, or it's the word that we use, I should say, when we talk about the ever-rising cost of healthcare and college, when we talk about the coronation of Wall Street and the slow blighting of wherever it is that you happen to live. You catch a glimpse of this inequality every time you hear about somebody that had to declare bankruptcy because a child got sick, or when you read about the lobbying industry that drives my hometown of Washington, D.C., or the new political requirement we have in this country that every candidate must either be a billionaire's favorite or a billionaire themselves. Inequality is the word we use when we want to talk about the way that speculators and even criminals get a helping hand from Uncle Sam while a Vietnam vet down the street from you loses his house. Inequality is the reason that some people find such profound meaning in the ceiling height of an entrance foyer or the hop content of a beer, while other people will never believe in anything again. Inequality is a euphemism for the Appalachification of our world. And I know it. It's the Republicans. I know it. They're the ones who blame primary responsibility or who bear the primary responsibility for this modern plutocracy that we live in. This is the party that launched us on our era of tax cutting and wage suppressing. These are the guys that made a religion out of the free market and fought so ferociously to open our politics to the influence of money at every single level. But just blaming the Republicans and turning the TV back to MSNBC, folks, this is not good enough, not anymore. Because the things I'm describing also represent a failure of the Democratic Party as well. Think about, go back to when you were young, right? Protecting the middle class society, this is what the Democratic Party was all about. This was their traditional mission. And once upon a time, they would have taken one look at this situation that we're in today and they would have waded into the fight, right? They would have taken this on with a certain amount of relish. Shared prosperity was what the Democratic Party was all about. This was their highest aim. Defending the middle class was a kind of sacred mission for these guys. And they would never shut up about it, frankly, back in the day. And it's true that to this day, Democrats are still the ones that pledge to raise the minimum wage, as I understand they're going to do here in California, and also to raise the taxes of the rich. But when it comes to tackling what President Obama calls the defining challenge of our time, many of our modern Democratic leaders falter. Yes, they acknowledge that inequality is rampant, that inequality is awful. They're real sad about it. They're all broken up about it. But they can't find the conviction or the imagination to do what is necessary to reverse the trend. And instead, they offer us the same high-minded policy platitudes that they've been dishing up since the 1980s. They remind us, you know, they love to say this, oh, there's nothing anybody can do about technology. There's nothing anybody can do about globalization, right? That's the hand of God doing that stuff. And they promise us charter schools or job training or, you know, they'll shovel out the student loans. They'll do all that stuff. But other than that, they got nothing. Now, let's take the issue of, I never stop talking about this. Let's take the issue of the Wall Street bailouts back in 2008 and 2009. And the reason I can never stop talking about it is because this is the inflection point. this is the moment, the defining moment of this young century that we're living in. This is the point where our country could easily have changed course, right? We had just elected President Barack Obama in this massive wave of hope and enthusiasm. And I don't know about you, but when I saw him speaking back in those days, I thought, this is the Franklin Roosevelt of our time. That's what I thought. And he was elected in that, you know, with those amazing rallies, this huge wave of popular support, and then proceeded to continue the policies of the Bush administration, essentially unchanged, at least for the first few years of his administration. No big banks got put into receivership. No bailouts got unwound. No elite bankers got prosecuted. But they were very zealous about prosecuting, by the way, individuals. If you lied on a mortgage application 10 years ago, the FBI is very interested in that. But if you're a company that's packaging up and selling off, you know, liars' loans, no problem, right? Now, this is an extraordinary thing. President Obama and his Democrats refused to change course when every sign was telling them to turn, when it would have been good policy to turn, when it would have been overwhelmingly popular to turn, when the country fully expected them to turn, and when it was completely within their power to steer the country in a different direction. Everybody's expecting them to. It would have been good for the economy. The Wall Street bankers themselves expected him to, you know, to take them to the woodshed. Do you remember that? They were so worried. Nothing to worry about, it turns out. What I'm saying is that on this essential question of the Wall Street banks and what to do about them, there was no conflict between pragmatism and idealism. And this is what we're always hearing about the conflict, the race with Hillary and Bernie, right? One is pragmatism, one is idealism. But on this issue, this critical issue, there was no conflict. The idealistic thing was also the practical thing. The idealistic thing was also the healthful thing and the popular thing. And still they chose not to do it. Now, I know that Democrats are the good guys, or rather the less bad guys. But it is not a coincidence that the economic gains of the recovery that we've had since those days, since 2009, the recovery we've had, presided over by a Democratic president, have gone entirely to the already wealthy, the upper 10% of the income distribution. And it is not, not only because sinister Republicans have thwarted the righteous liberal will that this has been happening. It's not simply because Republicans are awful. They are awful. I know that. But what we've got here is straight up Democratic failure. Now, I call this a failure, but you know the right word for it, which is betrayal. And the history of this betrayal goes back a long way. When I was a child, you know, I'd read the newspapers, and the Democratic Party was always fighting over its identity. Who they were and what they stood for. And this went on all through the 70s, all through the 80s, and up into the 1990s. And you had these different factions, right? There was one called the New Politics crowd. They came out of the 1960s, the anti-Vietnam War movement. You had a group called the Neoliberals. They were mainly in Washington, D.C. It was a group of journalists. They were obsessed with high tech. They called them the Atari Democrats, another name for them. Do you remember these guys? And then you had the New Democrats, which was a group of white Southern governors and senators, white Southern office holders, conservative Democrats. So you had all these different factions fighting with each other. But here's what's weird about it. There was one thing that they all agreed upon, and that was that the Democrats had to turn away from the legacy of the New Deal with its fixation on working class people. They fought over everything else, right? They fought like cats and dogs, but they agreed on that. The Democratic Party had to turn away from the legacy of the New Deal. Now, the guy who brought closure to that long Democratic civil war was President Bill Clinton, as we remember, who brought a new kind of Democratic administration to Washington, D.C. Rather than paying homage to the politics of Roosevelt, as Democrats had always done before him, Clinton did these sort of spectacular favors for Roosevelt's old enemies, the banks, the radio networks, the power companies, basically the bosses. He deregulated Wall Street, and this wasn't just one law. This was a whole series of things all through the 1990s, deregulating Wall Street. He ensured that derivative securities would be traded henceforth without supervision of basically any kind. It was kind of amazing. He deregulated radio and telecoms, and basically he put an end to the federal welfare system, to something that we'd had since 1935. Another thing that he did that most people don't know about was that in 1997, Bill Clinton struck a secret deal with Newt Gingrich, who was the Speaker of the House at the time. He struck a secret deal with Newt Gingrich to privatize Social Security. And this is not something that I have deduced from, you know, reading between the lines or something. This is now a matter of the record. This is known. The secret meetings that they had have been written up by historians. But the, you know, he was going to privatize Social Security. Gingrich had the votes. Clinton would sign on. They developed a whole plan for how it would unfold. You know, Clinton would propose it. Gingrich would offer a counterproposal. They'd set up a commission. The commission would arrive at this conclusion. It was all fixed. And Clinton even started on the scheme. It was in his 1998 State of the Union address. He said he was going to save Social Security first. Do you remember this? He didn't explain what he meant by that at the time. It sounded very grand and everything. But what he was referring to was the plan that he had developed with Gingrich to privatize it. And you know what destroyed this plan? Monica Lewinsky. The very next day, the scandal broke. And that was it. Look, if you ask me, she's a hero, you know? Seriously, they should. We should put her on a postage stamp. She saved. She saved Social Security. Hey, can I have some water? Is that okay? Now, if you're if you remember those days, you'll recall that Bill Clinton had a strategy as when he was running for the presidency. He had a strategy as a candidate, where he would go out of his way to insult or to distance himself from some traditional Democratic constituency, you know, like labor or minorities, thus assuring the public that he was his own man. The most famous example of this was Jesse Jackson, who Clinton maneuvered himself into a situation where he was able to basically insult Jackson to his face before the cameras of the nation. They called it his sister soldier moment. And the, you know, the particulars of it are pretty much forgotten today. But the idea of it was that he would thus assure the public that he wasn't beholden to any of the traditional Democratic constituents. And he did it. He thought it was okay to do this, that this was a safe thing for him to do, because these groups, labor and minorities, had remember how they used to always put this? They have nowhere else to go. That's what they would always say back in the Clinton days. Well, what are they going to do to me? You know, they got nowhere else to go. Now, what's weird is when you read the literature of the Clinton administration, and I don't mean like the crazy right-wing attacks on Clinton, but the serious historical, the scholarship about the Clinton years, what you find is that this campaign tactic of his, insulting members of his own constituency, eventually became a full-blown philosophy of government in which he would body slam the people who had got him elected. And the great example here is the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which was bitterly opposed by organized labor and most of the Democratic Party in Congress, but he got it through anyways. Remember, it had been negotiated by George Bush's dad, who was also president back in the... Sometimes I have to remind people, these, you guys know that, I know, but sometimes I'm talking to very young people and they're like, huh? So... George Bush's dad was also president, and he had negotiated this deal with Canada and Mexico, and he couldn't get it through Congress. That was Clinton did that. Clinton had to get it through. But when he did this, and this is the critical point. This is what's fascinating about this, or horrifying about this. He wasn't just insulting his friends, as he had done with Jesse Jackson. He was conniving in their ruin. He was assisting in the diminishing of labor's economic power. He was doing his part to undermine his own party's greatest ally, to ensure that in any future labor disputes, management would always have the upper hand over workers if they were to try to organize or go on strike or anything like that, because henceforth, management could always just threaten to move the plant to Mexico, which in fact they do all the time now, thanks to NAFTA, and also they sometimes follow through on it. So when he passed NAFTA, he didn't just insult his base, his constituents. He made their problems materially worse. Now, NAFTA is fascinating in all sorts of respects, and another way in which it's fascinating is that it was as close to a straight-up class issue as you ever see in this country. And it gives us an idea about who our modern democratic leaders intend to please, right? Professionals and the wealthy were very much in favor of NAFTA, and working people and unions and that sort of thing, they were very much opposed to NAFTA. It was a class divide right down the middle. So people with graduate degrees who have always favored NAFTA were no doubt impressed to learn that 283 economists had signed a statement declaring the treaty will be a net positive for the United States, both in terms of employment creation and overall economic growth. It was that kind of thing that went on in those days, all of these economists massively signing an open letter to the president, that sort of thing. And that was the divide. Now, ironically, the predictions of the people who opposed the agreement, many of whom hadn't even finished high school, those people turned out to be right. Well, the 283 economists, in their rosy scenario, turned out to have almost nothing to do with reality. Anyhow, I mean, look, that's just what happened, and we all know it now. And we'll talk about this more later. I mean, we're living with this now, and it's all around us today. But to continue with NAFTA, the thing was passed, and if you go back and read the literature of the Clinton years, his new Democratic allies regarded this as his finest moment. They would openly say this. This is a brave act. This is a fantastic presidential achievement. There was a biography of Clinton that came out in 1996 to coincide with his reelection by a British journalist, a fellow named Martin Walker, who he wrote in the book. He was talking about what a wonderful president Bill Clinton was, but he acknowledged that Clinton had a few failings, and he said that in the end his few failings were balanced and even outweighed by his part in finally sinking the untenable old consensus of the New Deal and the crafting of a new one. So for the president's admirers, for Clinton's admirers, this was the good thing about him, that he had sank the New Deal, that he had finally ended the New Deal consensus. That was what they liked about him, okay? And he built that new consensus, as Martin Walker put it. Well, who was this new consensus? Who are the heroes of this new consensus? The same Democratic thinkers that I was talking about at the beginning, the same Democratic thinkers who kept advising the party to abandon workers and to abandon the New Deal, had the answer. What Democrats had to embrace, they said, what Democrats had to become going forward was the emerging post-industrial economy, and the people that Democrats needed to identify with were the winners in this new order, not the working people or the hard done by or anything like that. They had to embrace the winners of this new economic order, the highly educated professionals who populated our innovative knowledge industries. And what I mean by professionals is lawyers, doctors, the math PhDs who write the derivative securities, the biochemists who make our prescription drugs, people with advanced degrees. Okay? Now, once upon a time, in sociological terms, in brute sociological terms, this group of people, professionals, were solid Republicans. If you can remember back to the 1950s, medical doctors in the 1950s would have been almost entirely, as a group, Republicans. Today, they have completely shifted, and professionals are among the most Democratic cohort there is, the most Democratic constituency in the country. And so that's who our Democrats are today. They are the party of the professional class. Now, they have other constituencies, to be sure. We've talked about them already, minorities, women, the young. Back in Washington, D.C., where I live now, Democrats have a name for their coalition. They call it the Coalition of the Ascendant. But in the Coalition of the Ascendant, the professionals are the ones who always come first. They're the ones whose technocratic outlook always prevails. And it's their tastes and manners that are always celebrated by liberal newspapers, artisanal everything, You know about this, right? You're in San Francisco. You've heard about this. It's like in Chicago, they're building all these bike lanes, right? And so my extremely cynical friends are like, Rahm Emanuel is a Republican with bike lanes. That's what it is. That's the difference, right? I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. That's cruel. That's too mean, being too mean to Rahm. No, I'm not. You can't be too mean to Rahm Emanuel. But within the Democratic coalition, this is the group that always prevails. This is the group who's they always defer to. This is a group that always gets what they want. Organized labor is out there always, if you know any of these guys, always so frustrated. Democrats take their money, take their votes, and never give them the time of day. You know, but professionals, oh my Lord, they bend over backwards for these people. They get whatever they want from the Democratic Party. And so what I'm saying is that professionals dominate liberalism in the Democratic Party in the same way that Ivy Leaguers dominate the Obama cabinet. And Democrats have, and this is not something that's secret, by the way, it's out in the open, they write about this all the time, they talk about it all the time, and they have all these flattering phrases for their favorite demographic, for their favorite group. They call these high-achieving professionals the wired workers who will inherit the future. They are a learning class that truly gets the power of education. I love that. A learning class. They're a creative class that naturally rebels against fakeness and conformity. They're an innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new stuff, you know? And Democratic leaders themselves are, of course, drawn almost exclusively from the ranks of this group, almost exclusively. You look at the life stories of both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton for that matter, and it's not a coincidence that all of these people were plucked from obscurity by prestigious universities. That's how they rose up in the world. Look at Bill Clinton's story. He was a kid in Hot Springs, Arkansas, this really out-of-the-way place. He goes to Georgetown University. He becomes a Rhodes Scholar. He goes to Yale Law School, and the doors of the world swing open for this guy. Or Barack Obama, another really talented kid from an out-of-the-way place, goes to Columbia University, goes to Harvard Law School, Harvard Law Review, and again, the same thing happens. This is their the time that they spend at fancy schools is what defines them as individuals, what makes them, what's made them successful. And you look at their cabinet choices or at their innermost circle of advisors, and it's always the same kind of people. These successful professionals whose worth is established by their achievements in college and graduate school. Right now, the Washington Post is forever marveling at Barack Obama's inner circle of advisors and how the concentrated brain power that you see. It's like we've had smart people in government forever, of course, but never anything like this. The number of advanced degrees and exalted prizes that these people have won, and Rhodes Scholars and all this kind of thing. It's extraordinary. Okay, so I'm all of these different ways of illustrating the shift, the party's shift of allegiance from the working and middle class to the professionals. All of these things, what I'm trying to get at here is that this is what explains so much that is frustrating about our modern-day Democrats. This is what explains, I think, the vexing problem of Obama and the banks. I mean, go back to the question that I started with. Why is it that the Obama team failed what needed to be done with the investment banks? Why did they declare that Wall Street executives were going to be held to a different legal standard than ordinary citizens? And they did say this. It was a slip-up, and the official of the Justice Department who said it later had to resign, but he said it. Why did they choose Wall Street over average people again and again and again? And they did. Why did they do that? And this is the answer I submit to you, that because for the achievement-conscious people who fill the Obama administration, investment bankers were more than just friends. These guys are their classmates. These guys are they themselves, right? There is no difference. The two groups are the same. You know, people go back and forth through this revolving door. There's no difference. Wall Street, the Democrats in the Obama administration take one look at Wall Street and they say, this industry is filled with people of subtle minds, with this beautiful, sophisticated jargon and extraordinary innovativeness, right? Always coming up with these great financial innovations, right? These are exactly the sort of creative individuals that Democratic Party theory tells us we must honor and respect, right? I mean, they're making these financial instruments that are so admirably complex. By the way, let me tell a little anecdote here. I have a friend who is a former bank regulator, and he was a bank regulator back in the 80s and 90s, and he had a hand in prosecuting the top officials of many SNLs back in those days. And he said, he told me, he was reading the manuscript of Listen, Liberal, and he said to me, you know, in my day, when we would see undue complexity in a financial institution, we would say that is a marker of fraud. That's a red flag. You know, let's dig there. Look at that. Let's zero in on that. When the Obama people see complexity in financial stuff, they're like, ooh, sophistication, right? For them, that is admirable. That's not a red flag. That's like, you know, that's awesome, right? It's like financial rocket science, as an Obama administration official once said. By the way, when he said that, he was talking about why they hadn't prosecuted any of these guys. Because it's, whoa, it's mind-blowing. It's financial rocket science. Nothing you can do. And this exact same thing is true with Big Pharma, right? So innovative. You can't go out there and import generic pharmaceuticals from Canada or from India or something like that. You can't do that. You have to protect these creative companies, these innovative companies. And, oh, mega dittos for Silicon Valley, right? Mega dittos for those guys. This is an industry that can do virtually no wrong in Democratic eyes up until this business with Apple and the FBI, right? But that's over now, right? They've smoothed that over. It's going to be back to status quo ante, right? I mean, Silicon Valley, these guys are so lovable, so professional, so creative, right? So creative, so innovative that for these guys, enforcement of our country's antitrust laws has basically been suspended. As Secretary of State Hillary Clinton used to travel the globe, declaring that access to certain Silicon Valley servers like Google and Facebook, that this stuff was a basic human right. That was the foreign policy of our country. She called it, what did she call it? Internet freedom. That was her term for it. So what does a party of the professional class look like? What does it believe in? Now, the most important item on their sort of philosophical list of philosophical things that they believe in, the most important item is meritocracy. This is the thing that always comes first, meritocracy. The conviction that the successful deserve their success and that the people who are on top are on top because they are the best, right? It makes sense. And this is the first commandment of the professional managerial class in this country. But let me tell you, this is not a particularly good way to take on the problem of income inequality, okay? Meritocracy. This is less of a doctrine for mitigating inequality than it is a doctrine for rationalizing inequality. You know, the idea that everyone gets what they deserve and what they deserve is defined by how well they did in school. This is just not going to get you very far. Now, why is that? What I'm saying here is that there is no solidarity in a meritocracy. It's the exact opposite idea, right? The leaders of the professional class, the people on top of the status hierarchy, they show this enormous respect for one another, right? This great deference for one another, but they have zero sympathy for the people down the chain from them, down the great chain of professionalism from them. Think about it. In the white-collar workplace, when somebody gets fired, their colleagues never go out and protest or rally around this person or go on strike or something. That never happens. Or it's very rare, I should say, in the white-collar workplace. Or think about what's happened with adjuncts in the university system. I myself got a PhD in history, back in 1994, and I went out on the job market, you know, I'm going to become a professor, right? And I discovered that academic labor, while I was in graduate school, academic labor had been casualized, and the only jobs available were adjunct work. You know what this is? Where you teach a class, like it meets three times a week, and you have to teach all semester, and you get $1,000 or something like that. And it's pittance, right? And this is what was going on. And what was the reaction of our elders, of the tenured professors in all the disciplines where this was happening? Do you think they had a lot of sympathy for us? Zero, folks. Well, not zero. There are good people here and there who felt really bad about it. But by and large, no, one of the reasons this happened is because there's no solidarity in meritocracy. They take one look at what's happened to you and they're like, well, you must have done something to bring this on yourself. Because in a meritocracy, you know, you get what you deserve. And if life doesn't shower its blessings on people who don't make the grade, it's not a shock or an injustice. It's the way things are supposed to be. That's always what they think. So, Okay, happy note. So the story I tell, think about it, there's a happy side to all this. The story I tell in Listen Liberal is happy from one vantage point, which is this is the coming together of money and merit. It's like the 19th century all over again. This is righteousness coming together with success. This is the marriage of finance and political virtue, right? And virtue and righteousness, that's what liberalism deals in these days. That's what it's all about. You get this together with big money, man, it's fantastic. But in another sense, I think the transformation of the Democratic Party has been a disaster. This transformation I'm talking about, think about it this way. Left parties all over the world were founded about 100 years ago to advance the fortunes of working people. That's why they exist. But our left party here in America, one of our two monopoly parties, lest we forget, our left party has chosen over the last 30 years to turn its back on those people's concerns, on the concerns of working people, and make itself instead into a tribune of the enlightened professional class, a creative class that makes these awesome things like derivative securities and smartphone apps. And the working people that the party used to care about, Democrats figured, had nowhere else to go, in the famous Clinton-era expression. Folks, they have found somewhere else to go. By abandoning them, Democrats have made inevitable both the economic desolation that we see around us, admittedly not here in San Francisco, but where I come from. They've made inevitable both that kind of economic desolation and the crazy populist backlash against liberalism that has been building slowly for decades. 10 years ago, I wrote about it, what it looked like back in my home state of Kansas. And today, folks, it is everywhere. It is swarming up out of the deindustrialized zones, screaming these bizarre, you know, ugly Trumpian slogans. And you just think about the choice that this strategy of the Democrats has essentially left us with this year. On the one hand, this sort of angry right-wing intolerance. And on the other hand, meritocracy forever, right? In the person of Hillary Clinton. Folks, there has got to be a different way. Thank you very much.
Yes. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is historian and political analyst Thomas Frank, and we are discussing his critique of the Democratic Party. I'm Professor James Taylor of the University of San Francisco, your moderator for the program. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Thank you so much, Thomas, for your comments and your initial thoughts. And there are a bunch of questions that I've dropped on the ground here that people have thought important to ask. I wanted to sort of get us started off a little bit and ask you if you could sort of help us understand where you see the two books, What's the Matter with Kansas and this current book, Listen Liberal. Where do they converge, or ideologically, where's the point of departure or the break-off point between these books?
I think of this current one, Listen Liberal, I think it picks up where the Kansas book left off. The last chapter of the Kansas book actually hinted at this theme about the professional class and Bill Clinton. I didn't go into it in detail, but let me illustrate it like this. Mm-hmm. That one of the, you know, populism in the 1890s, this movement that I look back to and that was so important in Kansas and is a very important attitude everywhere in America, it didn't leave much behind in the way of monuments or relics, but there is one. It's a sculpture garden out in western Kansas built by this populace. It's called the Garden of Eden. And if you ever go out there, if you're ever driving from Kansas City to Denver, you should visit it. It's made of cast concrete. And the guy basically spent his, you know, 20 years of his life building. He was kind of an eccentric fellow, right? And one of the things that he built was an allegorical sculpture. It's, it's not that allegorical because he's put names on everything so that you can figure out what it is. And it's a man nailed to a cross, and it says labor, right? It's labor crucified. And he's being crucified by four figures around the outside, and they are the professions: lawyer, doctor, preacher, and banker. Mm-hmm. And populism was in this weird kind of way a rebellion against. There's always been an antagonism mm-hmm. between the working class and the professional class, mm-hmm. and so the book sort of the Kansas book ends with hinting at this, and then I never went back to it until now, mm-hmm. And it just struck me one day that was the key to the whole damn thing. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I should say I don't mean to badmouth professionalism or learning or anything like that. I am a member of this group. Right. I write books for a living. Right. I got a PhD. I love knowledge. What would make me happiest in life is if I could spend the rest of my time in the Regenstein Library at the University of Chicago. You know, just go back into the stacks and read books all day long. I'm a total loser and a complete, you know, but.
Well, let me ask you this. And that is the title of this new book, Listen Liberal, like you said, you won an exclamation mark.
Yeah.
To make the point, but that was based on C. Wright Mills' work, Listen Yankee.
Yeah, that's right.
As a political scientist, C. Wright Mills' book, The Power Elite,
yes.
I think in 50 or 52, was written.
That's very important for me.
To what extent Listen Yankee and The Power Elite, I'm seeing echoes of both works in your book, and I'm wondering to what extent is C. Wright Mills an influence?
Well, he's quoted in this book, but I quoted a different essay of his. This is just another weird, you know, when you write a book like this, there's so many weird coincidences yeah. that happen. And one of them is when I was younger, when I was starting out as a journalist, one of the first things I wrote about was a strike in Decatur, Illinois. It was in the mid-90s. Anybody know about it? It wasn't widely covered in the press, but there were three unions out on strike in Decatur, Illinois, and the whole town, it's not a big city or anything, and the whole town was basically in a kind of civil war. They weren't shooting each other, but it was like they were just one stop short of that. And I went down there and wrote about it, and it was a fascinating story. And the people who were on strike were saying things like, you know, this is where if we lose, the middle class is going to go down. And I quote them as saying, you know, mm-hmm. all the things that they would say at the time, which turned out to be very accurate, weirdly enough. But then I later discovered, as I was writing this book, that C. Wright Mills had spent a lot of time in Decatur, right after World War II, 40 years before I went there. But wow. he was there, and he was studying it as an exemplar of Middle America. It was supposed to be the most average, one of the most average towns you could find. He had done some kind of study, and. Okay, this is fascinating. So he found out how much people made in different occupations in Decatur, Illinois. And what did management, I'm sure he was looking at the very same companies that I went down there that were on strike, because these are the big industrial employers in the town. Management made, and this is going to blow your mind, you know how much more they made than the workers? Twice as much. You know how much they make today? It's like the CEOs of these companies compared to their workers. It's like 500 times as much. Yeah. But right after World War II, it was a different world.
Yeah.
Anyhow,
this is when, FDR comes up with the Economic Bill of Rights in 1944. Mm-hmm.
That's right. The
right to a job, the right to a house, the right to education. And, of course, he didn't win the day in the long run. So let me go back to some of the questions that have come from the floor. There are a bunch of Bernie Sanders questions, so I'll try to read these together and see if you can outline them, because they're very general.
Okay.
do you think Sanders' constituency will force Hillary to the left being demonstrative? So do you see that happening?
Oh, yeah, that's already happening.
Do you see Bernie's critique as a positive alternative to the future of the Democratic Party?
Yes, I do. And several people have asked, Bernie is not actually mentioned in the book. You know why?
And you got a question here that says you didn't even mention Bernie once. Why?
Yeah. I love to talk about Bernie, but every time I do this talk, somebody raises their hand and wants to talk about Bernie, and I'm happy to. I love to. The reason he's not mentioned in the book, he wasn't a Democrat when I wrote the book. And this is also why you look at the superdelegates, you know, he's only got like three of them or something like this. And that's because he has spent all this time in Congress and he's not a Democrat. He only signed up with the Democratic Party to run as a Democrat. But I'll tell you, when I met him in 2014 and interviewed him for Salon, and he was talking about running for president, and I thought, here we have another, you know, he's a good man, he's a good guy, so was Ralph Nader, you know, and here's another, but no, this is, this man who comes from Vermont, who has a serious Brooklyn accent, who's, you know, in his 70s, and it, you know, really comes from the fringes of American political life, has managed to beat a Clinton at primary after primary. It's mind-blowing. I can't believe it's happening. It's the most extraordinary thing, And I'll tell you, I mean, I'm also read the newspapers, and I'm realistic. I think Hillary will probably be the nominee, but Bernie has showed the way, and this is the critical thing. He has showed us that it is possible to run a serious campaign for the presidency without Wall Street money behind you, without any billionaires behind you, and to succeed at it. And there's going to be 4 years from now, there's going to be another Bernie.
You projected there might be another Bernie another Trump in the next four years.
Yeah, there'll be another Trump, too. That's the new normal. Their Republicans are never going to get the Trump phenomenon back under control. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the base of their party that they have taken for granted all these years. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be very hard for them to get the lid back on this thing. And look, same with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But the limitations on the Trump thing are, how many billionaires do you have that are going to do stuff like this? Mm-hmm. The number is very small.
Do you think the election of Bernie Sanders could actually make a positive difference? Or do you think
you mean if he were to become president?
Yeah.
Is
obstruction too much of an influence in our politics?
You mean would the Republicans stop him
from
doing
anything?
Yeah,
he's a socialist, he's scary.
Sure, of course. Well, the same thing that's happened to Obama, with a couple differences. He, you know, he wouldn't appoint Larry Summers to run.
Right, that's for sure.
That. You know, he wouldn't bring in Tim Geithner.
Rahm Emanuel.
Rahm Emanuel would not have a seat at the table. Right. And you know what else? There are a lot of things. I live in D.C. I live among Democrats, and we talk about these things all the time. You know, and they say there's nothing. Look, you're so hard on Obama. There's nothing he can do. The Republicans are so mean, and they're so clever, and they're almost satanic. You know, the way they play the game. And it is true, they play a hard, mean game of politics. But the presidency is a very powerful office, and there are all sorts of things that the president can do. And do you want me to just list a few?
Mm-hmm.
Antitrust. Now, we have all these antitrust laws in the books. They go back 100 years. Republicans haven't overturned them, and they're not about to. They're not about to go out there and pass a law saying monopoly is okay in America. And until they do that, it's up to the president to enforce them. Obama has chosen not to. And we have monopolies. It's not only do we have monopolies everywhere, it's openly the business strategy of Silicon Valley. And if whoever the president is, the next president is, needs to, I'm really sorry about this, folks, because I know this is your home industry.
Yeah, you are in Silicon Valley right now.
I know that, but whoever the next president is needs to come here with a sledgehammer. I'm really sorry to say. If you care about
it. Right, right. Right.
There are a couple other things. You know what would change inequality? This would be tough for a president to do all on his own, but you know what would reverse the inequality spiral? If you had a labor organizing wave in this country like you did in the 1930s, it would turn things around like that.
Yeah.
You know, all these inequality fatalists, all these people say that, you know, there's absolutely nothing you can do. That would change it. Yeah. Antitrust would change it. A handful of things would be all it takes.
Speaking of Tom Hartman, who you did your show with, I think Great Minds of American Minds, et cetera. He's very clear about the problem of inequality. He recommended this book called The Spirit Level, written by two British scholars that do this whole, they marshal in all this data that show that, and the subtitle has changed more than once in this book, but it has something to do with those societies that are more equal are happier. That was the initial title, to convey that inequality is the source of crime, truancy, education policy, health issues. It's almost a Trojan horse, that affects all these other areas.
I think that's right. I just think of the nostalgia that we have for, I mean, above and beyond the usual nostalgia for the middle class society.
But when you got like Bill O'Reilly, I mean,
can I add on that?
Go ahead.
Even have nostalgia for the problems of the middle class society.
Yeah.
I wrote an essay about Mad Men, you know, there's the show, right? And and how Mad Men was not just, it wasn't exactly nostalgic for the 50s and 60s, it was nostalgic for the social problems of the 50s and 60s. For like, you know, when conformity was the big problem in America, right? If only we could have, and when, you know, people littering was the big problem. If only those were our problems again, you know? That would be awesome. Yeah. And if we all, you know, we all had 62 Cadillacs or whatever was, you know?
No, and this is Bill O'Reilly's, you know, socialization and his worldview. I mean, in Levittown, Long Island, the first suburb ever created in the country, along with the one in Pennsylvania, the Levittown in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, Mad Men, that's all Bill Riley's experience. So what you're talking about, this, you know, I see that conservatives often mourn the lost paradises of their imaginations.
Yeah.
And the liberals are always searching for utopias.
I think that's very... Yeah, I think it's very human, the nostalgic impulse, because the past is a safe place. And so we're by nature nostalgic. But I would also say that progress is just as much an illusion as the idea of the past is a safe. Progress is a superstition as well. Things go up, things go down. You know, the Roman Empire, then the Dark Ages. It you know, sometimes you have progress, sometimes you don't. And right now we're in a time of extraordinary progress in some terms, like the smartphones, and everything else is like, you know, they don't fly the Concorde anymore. We don't land on the moon anymore. Right. You know, everything else seems to be going backwards.
Speaking of the iPhone, there's a question here at the top. It says, regarding breaking into Apple phone, what do you think happens if the Justice Department does not tell Apple how it was done?
Wouldn't that be funny? Yeah. Like, turn the tables on them.
Yeah, it's like, you think you're smart. Let's see. I thought this is a response to one of your comments. I thought the Department of Justice stopped pursuing convictions within finance because they had suffered a series of embarrassing acquittals, not because of politics.
If there were acquittals, I don't know about them. That would require a high profile trial,
right.
And I don't know about that. Yeah. They have won these extraordinary judgments against these guys, billions of dollars, against these firms. But the problem with that is that it's not the individuals in the firm who pay, it's the shareholders. And, you know, it's the individuals in the firm who are in these, in a case of white collar crime, the way it happens. By the way, and this is, let's get into the nitty gritty of this a little bit because it's fascinating. There's a federal prosecutor who's on this, on this case, and he has said, I'm going to butcher it, I can't get the quotation right, but that it doesn't make sense to him that an executive of a company would defraud his own company because then the company goes out of business. He's like, that doesn't make sense. Ipso facto, it doesn't happen. You know, and so I'm not going to look for it. And it's like, wait a second, have you ever heard of a bonus? You know, they win these bonuses. They win these bonuses if they do certain things, and if they have to commit fraud to do these certain things and get the bonus, they still keep the bonus, even if the company goes bankrupt. It's really, really, really simple. But our government doesn't believe that takes place. So they, you have them prosecuting the, not prosecuting, but fining, you know, the big Wall Street banks. Gigantic fines, like unprecedented fines. But the people who are responsible aren't paying for that. Yeah.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is historian and political analyst Thomas Frank, and we're discussing his critique of the Democratic Party. I wanted to sort of follow up a little bit with another question related to the title of the book, Liberal, Listen Liberal. In San Francisco, I think it was Richard DeLeon at San Francisco State who wrote the book Left Coast Politics and describes the politics of San Francisco from an urban politics standpoint. And he talks about pluralism and the hyper-pluralism of San Francisco, where a liberal here is the conservative.
Really?
Really. I mean, in other words, if someone in this room identifies as a liberal, they're probably the most conservative person in the room. I would say that was true before the .com and Facebook phenomena. I think maybe 7-10 years ago that was true. I don't know if that's true today, and maybe the audience can answer that question better. But I guess I'm sort of trying to figure out, you know, to what extent you imagine this to be relevant, you know, today in overall.
There is, I think there's a certain element to that. Okay, let's look at, so Barack Obama, I voted for Barack Obama in 2008 thinking candidate of hope and change. I really believed in it. I thought this was the Franklin Roosevelt of my generation. I was excited for him. I was excited for change. Jonathan Alter wrote a book about the 2012 election, the next one after that, where he goes up against Mitt Romney and beats Mitt Romney. And the title of Alter's book is The Center Holds.
Right.
So, you know, forget the hope and change. This is now, that's openly what brought, and this is a great, he's a great admirer of, yeah, of President Obama, yeah, by the way. The center holds. And you look at Hillary Clinton and the way she's running now, and this will, especially if Donald Trump is her opponent, and I assume he will be, she will be the candidate of complacency. What is her slogan now? You know, Trump is going around saying, make America great again. And she's like, America is already great. We don't need to change anything. And by the way, I've been, I have met a lot of, you know, when Democrats talk about what they have to do in the future and who their constituencies are, and they basically don't think they need to do anything because they've got, because of the demographic changes that are happening in this country, they don't think they need to do anything differently. They're going to win from here on. This is the idea of the coalition of the ascendant. Our coalition gets bigger and bigger. The Republican coalition shrinks and shrinks. And that's without us changing a thing.
Yeah.
And this breeds complacency. Yeah. I mean, they are a party that is very satisfied with who they are. One more story. One more anecdote. I'm sure there'll be many more, but okay. I live in Montgomery County, Maryland these days, a suburb of Washington, D.C. It's a very affluent suburb, and there's a race underway for a seat in the House of in the House of Representatives. And it's all Democrats at this point. There might not even be a Republican opponent. It's all Democrats. It's like 10 Democrats running against each other. You know, it's wild. It's this wild fight, and it is already on track to be the most expensive House election of all time, and it's just the primaries. These are all these millionaires spending and spending and spending to thrash one another, and they're all like, these are very contented people living in beautiful homes in one of the richest places in America, and that's the Democratic Party.
Wow. We're running out of time, so let me get a couple of quick questions in here. One is, you know, in political science, we talk about the Tweedledee, Tweedledum nature of the two major parties. I wonder if you agree with that Tweedledee, Tweedledum phenomenon.
That's,
but I really want to get at this point with liberalism in the book. Who are the liberals? Because I'm wondering, as I chide my students all the time, I am trying to find a well-known national political figure who openly identifies himself as liberal verbally.
Yeah.
No one in America since 1988, since Willie Horton has openly said they're liberal. No one says they're liberal. Who's liberal in this room?
I say it.
Right, but do you openly say it publicly? Like, think about this in our politics. Conservatives, every three words is conservative. It has been for 40 years.
Yeah.
And the liberals have been very shy to say, I'm a liberal, ever since George Bush, the father, stood up and held out the L word on Dukakis because of Willie Horton and
That's
said,
right.
You are a liberal. From that second on, Americans have been reluctant. They even came up with a new word called progressive that nobody knows what it means. So I'm trying to figure out, when you talk about liberal listen, I'm wondering, who are you talking to? Because nobody proudly identifies himself as a liberal.
That is a shortcoming, all right? Yes, that's right. I call myself that. I always have, and especially when Dukakis, what you're describing, he wouldn't use that word to describe himself, and that cheesed me off. And that's when I decided from now on I'm always going to refer to myself as a liberal.
Yeah.
Look, I like the title because it rings. And I'll tell you another anecdote. I love anecdotes. So I was in Wichita, Kansas. The Kansas book had come out. There was a reporter for one of the publication there who was supposed to meet my hotel. He's down in the lobby. He rings the phone. I answer, and it's early in the morning or something. And he says, "Rise and shine, liberal." I always loved that. I always thought there was something just funny, just kind of humorous about that.
Right.
And so listen, liberal.
Right.
You know. But you're absolutely right, and we can't own up to our own heritage.
Yeah.
I mean, people are so afraid of it, you know.
And that's what I had here is, why are Dems afraid to run on liberalism?
Yeah, why are they? And by the way, so Bernie, a very interesting case study, calls himself a socialist.
Yeah.
Now, why? He's a New Dealer. You know, you look at what he stands for. It's very familiar.
Right.
There's nothing exotic or strange or European about it.
Right.
It's very familiar. But he insists on calling himself a socialist. And I don't get that.
He's closer to Martin Luther King in his ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. He's very familiar.
And people don't realize that. And I've said this here on Channel 2. recently that Bernie Sanders is the closest the civil rights movement has gotten to the White House, that Barack Obama doesn't represent that tradition, even though there was a black political strategy, presidential strategy, 72 Gary, Indiana convention. But you don't see, and Jesse Jackson didn't get that. He was from that tradition, but he doesn't get that close to the White House. Bernie Sanders is every bit legitimately a part of the civil rights movement. Like here in San Francisco, Terrence Hallinan was one of the leaders of CORE. Am I correct? In San Francisco, a white Jewish radical liberal who became the district attorney of the city before Kamala Harris, right? And now you have this similar thing with Bernie Sanders.
I never thought of it that way.
And it's amazing to me, the more profound part of that is that the black vote and the woman vote, the minority vote so-called, is being expected to prevent the election of the civil rights movement's last standing candidate. And that's the when you talk about capture, the fact that the black vote is beholden to the Democrats, even as they, to the Clintons, given their record, their horrible, horrible record that Michelle Alexander is now exposing.
Yeah.
It's stunning to me to see what's happening
by the way,
this election.
Just so you guys, by the way, I can't top that. You've done that. You said that exactly right. You said that exactly right. Michelle Alexander wrote The New Jim Crow. This is the book about mass incarceration, the book about mass incarceration. It's awesome. Listen, Liberal has a long passage about mass incarceration in the Clinton years, and I go into it in great detail. And if you want the details, you know, I've got the whole thing there. It's ugly, ugly, ugly. And nobody noticed at the time. I remember in 1994 how angry it made me, the crime bill of 1994. Mm-hmm. But the public debate, you guys remember this, the public debate was all about midnight basketball. Do you remember that? Nobody even talked about the fact that they were now going to be able to try 13-year-olds as adults, that we had increased the number of federal death penalties from 3 to 60, that we were doing 3 strikes, 0 tolerance. You know, we're abolishing parole all over America. We want to talk about midnight basketball. Yeah. It was crazy. It was a crazy time. Anyhow, I bring it all up in the book. And when I was researching this book, it took a while to write. When I was researching Listen Liberal, I was interviewing or phoning all of these experts on mass incarceration and on, you know, prison policies and on sentencing policies. And one of them said to me, I'll never forget this. She said, you know, Tom, you can be as passionate as you want about this, but no one will care. There's nothing you can do to make people care about this. And I know where she was coming from because she'd been working on this subject for 20 years and could not make people care about it. And the country gets worse and worse every 4 years and we send more and more people to prison. But I'll be damned if Black Lives Matter, since that conversation, Black Lives Matter has turned this whole conversation around.
Very powerful.
And, you know, it's a fantastic thing. We are in a new day on that subject as well.
I'm going to try to get as many of these questions in as I can. And my wife is walking out the door. She actually came. I'm so glad to see her. She probably doesn't want me to draw attention to her leaving, but she has to go back to work. Thank you for coming, Yasmin. So real quickly, why do so many people dislike or distrust unions in the United States?
It's the word. The word union is a red flag. If you ask people, would you like an organization that'll bargain on your behalf with your boss? They'd be like, hell yes, you bet. Would you like to get proper pay, proper benefits, you know, all these things? They're like, oh yeah, you bet I would. You know, those things are extraordinarily popular, you know. But the word union has, I mean, they have done a propaganda number on this word like you wouldn't believe.
The same thing with Obama's policies, you know. If you just leave the policy there, people like it.
Yeah.
If you put Obama's name on it, they don't like it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Or you attach Trump to it, they like it, but if you put Obama, they don't like it.
I had not thought of that.
When will a compelling case be made for Hillary's emergence?
Hillary's emergence.
I think that's what I see here.
It's
a little hard to see.
I'm not sure I get that.
What are the three top things Democrats should
do? There's a chapter in the book about Hillary and her life story. She has a fascinating life story. I read all the big biographies of Hillary, and her own life as a professional is very fascinating. She's very, we all know the Hillary story, right? She's super intelligent, went to Yale Law School with Bill, went to Arkansas, became this high-powered lawyer in Arkansas. And do you remember the moment in the 92 campaign that tripped her up, where she was talking the thing about baking cookies and Loretta Lynn? The other part of that conversation was that what a woman should be doing is rising in her profession. And she has the professional mindset like no one I've seen, you know, much more so than Bill and much more so than Barack Obama. She is very tuned in, and that's, you know, her whole campaign is about breaking glass ceilings. That's the one thing that she's passionate about, that she really believes in. That's her life story. Now, that's really great, you know, and that is a problem in America, and all the, all that. I'm totally in favor of that. And, you know, having a woman president would be awesome. Mm-hmm. However, I think we have a, you know, inequality is a, you know, is what about the floors? Yeah. You know, I mean, the glass ceiling is a problem, but the, it's the, you know, the floors are a much, yeah, much worse problem, and they are descending, friends. They are going down.
So Angela Davis is calling for a third party, a labor party.
Who is?
Angela Davis, the radical from the 60s here. She's recently called for a labor party with a labor party base. Something like the Rainbow Coalition, I imagine, with a labor face. Do you think that's viable? Can we have a working class candidate? Can a pro-working class candidate win a national election in the young 21st century? Paul Wellstone or Bernie?
I know. Or Ralph Nader. All my life, people have been trying to build some kind of third party of the left, and everything has come to naught. And look, I love third parties. You mentioned I was used to be a historian, and populism was my favorite. But the 19th century was filled with third parties that were successful. The Republican Party started as a third party. And what happened between between populism and our day, populism really scared the hell out of people. We were talking about this in the green room, especially in the South, but also in Kansas, also all over the Midwest, because it appeared to be a radical movement. And so once populism had died down, the two major parties in every state where populism had been big passed laws against the electoral techniques that populism had used, namely something called fusion, where you would cross endorse someone from, you would set up a system with one of the two major parties to break the monopoly, and that's now illegal everywhere in America. Now there's no good reason, there's no principle, there's nothing in the Constitution why it should be illegal. It just is. Because the two parties want to make sure that never happens again. And until the day you do away with those laws, third-party movements are going to be futile. Because you're always just a spoiler. Yeah. It's the Ralph Nader problem.
Yeah. The best luck they can expect, I think, is local, like Matt Gonzalez here in city council.
There are examples here and there. You know, in New York, they have the working family. New York is one of the only states that doesn't have these laws. And so you have a very robust third-party movement in New York State.
We're out of time. Let me get this last question in, because it captures several of these other questions that were submitted. And it says, given Jane Meyer's documentation of the Koch brothers, funding for a vast right-wing conspiracy to fight progressive policy, isn't it unrealistic to expect Obama or anyone of the Democratic column to radically shift the American political landscape? And I want to add this, that the CQ Quarterly in 2010 rated Obama as the most effective, at least in terms of introducing legislation in American history, more than LBJ, more than FDR, between 2008 and 2010.
No, that's right.
Obama was the most aggressive president in American history, and then the backlash happened in the form of the Tea Party, and we forget that.
Yeah,
but Obama was on pace to outrun both those great presidents.
He had three great achievements, but none of them went far enough. Mm-hmm. Look, he could have really changed the landscape, the political landscape in this country. And at the end of the day, when I look back, and I know we're out of time, when I look back at Obama's the period where he could have had whatever he wanted, and he really could have had whatever he wanted if he had Rahm Emanuel, if he could have disciplined Rahm Emanuel a little bit, disciplined Larry Summers a little bit, he could have really had some progressive legislation.
Right.
And you wonder, the question that everybody who writes about Obama comes back to is, why didn't he do it? Why didn't he do it? And the answer ultimately that I have to give is that he didn't want to.
Yeah.
He did exactly what he wanted. He wanted Obamacare to be this immensely complicated, difficult to understand compromise within a compromise within a compromise. He wanted Dodd-Frank to be 20,000 pages long, that nobody can understand. He wanted the stimulus to be, something that you can't remember a single goddamn thing they spent the money on anymore,
Right.
It's a terrible shame, but I think he got what he wanted.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.